This is AMDA On The Go, your gateway to expert discussions, journal article reviews, and innovation in post-acute and long-term care. AMDA On The Go is a presentation of the Society for Post-Acute and Long-Term Care Medicine. Support for this podcast is brought to you by U.S. Post-Acute Care. This podcast is eligible for ABPLM pre-approved certified medical director credits. Details will be provided at the end of this podcast. And now here's our host for AMDA On The Go, Dr. Wayne Saltzman.
Welcome to AMDA On The Go. While we have had many conversations around advanced care planning on this podcast, today we will focus on a potential component of advanced care planning, the physician orders for life-sustaining treatment, or PULSED, its evolution and use today, especially in the midst of the COVID-19 pandemic. In a 2016 article from the AMA Journal of Ethics entitled Overcoming Legal Impediments to Physician Orders for Life-Sustaining Treatment, Attorney Marshall Kapp discussed barriers to the adoption and implementation of PULSED, no longer called the PULSED paradigm, such as legal repercussions that physicians feared they might suffer, even among the widespread criticisms of the current state of aggressively over-medicalized dying in the United States, and the call for quality medical and supportive care towards the end of life. There are continued concerns that individuals do not understand or are not able to characterize PULSED, so it is either not utilized or it is utilized incorrectly. How can this be? As discussions around the first PULSED program began in Oregon in 1991, why are we still having difficulties understanding PULSED 30 years later, especially during the COVID-19 pandemic, when calls for advanced care planning and determinations for goals of care and conversations are on everyone's front burner? Well, I can think of no two people better at providing some clarity around PULSED than thought leader, policy expert, educator, and AMDA, the Society for Post-Acute and Long-Term Care Medicine President-elect, Dr. Carl Steinberg, and the National PULSED Office Chief Executive Director, Amy Vandenbroek. And we are fortunate to have them both with us now. Ms. Vandenbroek has served in her current capacity since 2013, and before that, she was the legal counsel for an academic medical center. She also has completed an ethics fellowship at Portland State University in Oregon. She's a 2015 practice change leader for aging and health, a year-long program jointly supported by the Atlantic Philanthropies and the John A. Hartford Foundation, and a Hartford Change Agent through the Hartford Change Agents Initiative. Dr. Steinberg, who has been on the program multiple times, is also the Vice President of National PULSED and past chair of the Coalition of Compassionate Care for California. He has been a hospice and nursing home medical director since 1995. Ms. Vandenbroek and Dr. Steinberg, welcome to AMDA On The Go.
Thank you for having us.
Thanks.
Ms. Vandenbroek, I typically like to start our segments with somewhat of a historical perspective to set our framework for discussion. Can you tell us about the etiology of the PULSED movement? I guess starting 30 years ago, its evolution, structure, and it has a task force, you know, along with the establishment of the national office with its mission, vision, and goals.
Yeah, happy to. First, I would like to do a reminder that we actually have 16 different names for PULSED. So you might know it as POST, MOST, MULSED. I'm going to use the word PULSED in this podcast.
Sure.
And PULSED exists because other advanced care plans like advanced directives and do not resuscitate or DNR orders don't address all of the needs of those who are seriously ill or frail. A DNR provides really limited information, and if the patient is responsive, has a pulse, breathing, the DNR order doesn't matter because the question is no longer whether the patient wants to be resuscitated, but what level of treatment and what other medical interventions the patient wants during that medical crisis. And a DNR orderly doesn't provide that time-sensitive critical information. And we know from research that not all patients wanting a DNR order want the same level of other treatment. And so PULSED helps them make those wishes clear. As for advanced directives, while everyone should have them to at least identify their surrogate, these documents aren't even going to be looked at until the patient gets to the hospital. And not all patients who are seriously ill or frail want to be transferred to the hospital. Or even if they're okay being transferred, they don't all want to go into the ICU. So PULSED gives orders first about whether to transfer, and then if yes, whether the patient wants to be in the ICU once they arrive at the hospital. Impulse is unique in promoting a process that involves a conversation that's very specific about goals of care, diagnosis, prognosis, and treatment options between a provider and the patient, and then documenting those decisions on what we're calling a portable medical order called a PULSED form. PULSED is not just for emergencies. The goals of care section, typically found section B on the form, gives directions to providers about what to provide for treatments not covered by the form. So that's why we exist. The advance directives weren't sufficient. And as for our structure, as you mentioned, PULSE started in the mid-1990s, and by 2004, six states had implemented it. And those state leaders realized that there needed to be some similarity in the PULSE process and in their forms in order for PULSE to ultimately be successful. So they started what was then called the National PULSE Paradigm Task Force. And that task force established a process for creating and promoting standards, including form standards. And they also helped states starting to implement PULSE work towards those standards by providing advice on education, legislation, committee structure, pilot programs, form templates, et cetera. In 2017, we had a number of changes. We no longer have a task force. Instead, we changed to a more formal 501c3 structure. So National PULSE, we lost the paradigm at the beginning of this year. So National PULSE has what we call our Leadership Council, which is essentially a board of directors, and Carl serves as our vice president. And we have our plenary assembly, which is a group of state leaders who participate in making national policies and decisions about PULSE standards. Our vision is for all states to have adopted PULSE in a way that a patient can have a PULSE form in one state and be able to travel anywhere in the US and have it recognized, understood, and honored. National PULSE is responsible for managing and educating about the national standards appropriate for PULSE processes and form use. We serve as the backbone of the initiative coordinating guidance, research, education, policy, and quality assurance activities for all PULSE programs to follow. And I really want to emphasize two things. First, within the advanced care planning world, PULSE is really unique in having this national group collaborate and make decisions about the standards for this process and really one form. And there isn't anything similar for advanced directives or do not resuscitate orders. And this gives us a lot more potential and possibility for making PULSE work ultimately for patients and providers. And the second thing I want to emphasize is that all the state leaders choosing to participate in National PULSE do so because they share the same vision of making PULSE easier for patients, caregivers, and professionals. They recognize the need for consistency and uniformity to make PULSE successful. And so we invite all PULSE programs to participate, and currently 44 states and DC do, and they're listed as active if you go to our website and look at our map. And PULSE success isn't possible without their commitment to the big picture of making PULSE easier and their willingness to collaborate and find consensus, which is definitely not always easy. But that's hopefully a good overview of the history. Carl, did you have anything to add?
Oh, not really, other than, we've kept it kind of like AMDA, the Society for Post-Acute and Long-Term Care Medicine. We've kept the letters of the acronym, but not the actual acronym. So even though in some places by statute, it is physician orders for life-sustaining treatment, we've moved away from that, but we've kept the word PULSED. And there's a, because it's not always a physician who signs it, the term life-sustaining treatment might be a little bit value-laden. And so just so people understand that PULSED is now its own word and it's not, it doesn't stand for physician orders, but they are portable orders.
Yeah, thanks, Carl. That's actually a great thing to emphasize is that we really try to promote that PULSED is all about a healthcare team approach. And so not just physician sign, but in many states, nurse practitioners, APRNs, and physician assistants are able to sign this. And we want to encourage that, not only for the signing of the form, but also for the conversations needed to complete the form. And we actually go beyond that and encourage, social workers and chaplains, whoever's going to help the patient appreciate their diagnosis and prognosis, to be involved so that the patient has the right frame of mind to then have a concrete conversation about goals of care and treatment options and what all that really means for that individual patient.
As a segue from this last question, especially now that we understand how the acronyms have been used and changed or are different among different states. You know, it is clear that in ongoing conversations and literature around PULSE that it has had and continues to have its challenges. You know, what are the greatest challenges or barriers that PULSE faces today? Why is there such difficulty adopting PULSE among the states, even though they're among 44 states today? Has any state, you know, just refused to adopt? And, you know, what actions has the national office taken to improve PULSE implementation?
That's a great question. I'll start by saying no one's refused. We actually have leaders in all 50 states and DC who I can reach out to and ask about the program. There are a couple of states who, for one reason or another, just have a program that's set up in a way that doesn't necessarily meet national standards, but they're still doing really good work with what they're doing, and it's something that's very similar to PULSE. Finally, PULSE, we're really a collaborative. We want to build consensus, we want to be inclusive, and we want to be transparent. This is all voluntary. There's no authority I have to punish any program or, you know, kick them off the island. And so we really want to kind of come together and share that vision and work towards that common agreement wherever we can find it. And it's been fascinating to watch the movement over the last 30 years, because we started off with this idea. It started from the very beginning, was kind of different in these different six different states. And we've had a lot of experimentation, and I'm going to talk a bit more about the National PULSE Forum now. In reviewing all 47 forms that were in existence over the last 2.5 years, I've seen that even though we've had this experimentation, we keep coming back to similarities among the different states' approaches and forms themselves. So I think it's been an interesting process, but it is all voluntary and collaborative. And so I do want to thank the Gordon and Betty Moore Foundation and the John A. Hartford Foundation for supporting work on this forum and being able to do this review that gives a new sense of clarity about where we've been and where we can go. And as I've mentioned, although it's implemented at the state level, PULSE is not truly a state program. It's just implemented there because advanced care planning is, but we're really a national movement, and we need to be thinking about patients who live on borders, who travel between different states, and who want to use PULSE. And so any variation we have can undermine our purpose and make it more difficult. And our goal is really to make sure that patient wishes are respected. So it really shouldn't matter what state they're in or what form they're using. It just should matter if they've had a conversation, they have a PULSE form, and they're trying to express their wishes. And so since many people, including our partners, are surprised when I say reciprocity provisions aren't particularly helpful, and there's been some focus on them in the last couple of years, I want to share two recent stories that came up. And the first, and these stories are going to be familiar to any provider who has patients that travel, live on state borders, or who are snowboards, living up north for half of the year and south the other half. First, I was recently asked what PULSE form a person should have because they lived in Vermont, worked in New York, and their primary care was at Dartmouth in New Hampshire. And those are three different forms, three different names, and three different colors. You have New York's MULST, Vermont's CULST, and those documents don't really look like a typical PULSE form or like each other's, but New Hampshire's PULST does look like most other states. Assuming that she was right for PULSE, my answer at this point has to be that she needed all three versions, which is a horrible solution, since we're basically telling her she needs to find a provider who could either sign all three, or she needed to have a different provider in all three states. And then on top of it, she needs to keep track of three forms, meaning that she would need to have all of them on her when she traveled, and when she updated one, she had the burden of updating the other two. And from the patient perspective, I have to think that sounds pretty horrible and burdensome. And then the second story was from a caregiver whose patient was going to be traveling from South Carolina through North Carolina, Georgia, Tennessee, and back. And they were worried, and they really didn't want to use the South Carolina DNR because they wanted to have the value of PULSE, but they wanted to find the document that was going to provide the most support on this journey. And again, I had to tell her that first I needed to contact all those state leaders to see what the answer was with reciprocity. And then otherwise, you know, she needed, again, four copies of this document to make sure that it would be honored in each. And she ultimately, from a time perspective, went with the DNR because it was easier. And these are horrible things because I feel like we're failing our patients who want to use a PULSE when we're making it so challenging. And so even if legal reciprocity exists, and I know it does in a number of the states, it still presents challenges for using a pulse form because one, providers, especially first responders, need to be able to recognize a pulse in an emergency. Again, we have 47 versions, 5 colors, and 16 names. So if emergency personnel don't recognize pulse for what it is, then there's really no value in having it because the patient might get something that they didn't want. And then even if they recognize that it is in fact a pulse form, the next question is, do they have immunity for following it? In some states, there's specific provisions. It has to be substantially similar or it needs to be almost identical in order for them to have immunity protections. So if they don't know that they can actually follow that form, again, what's the value of having it? So we created this national form to help patients, providers, and caregivers more easily understand, use, and honor pulsed forms. And we also created it because, one, if we can have more uniform and consistent education, everyone will understand pulse better, and because they'll be given the same information, and that really can only help us all together. And this would also then increase the potential and the recognition of pulse as an advanced care planning tool because people would understand it better. Mm. Otherwise, it would also increase, it could increase the quality of pulse because right now our data is very state specific and we would be able to do more data collection and research nationwide, which would probably be beneficial to all of us. We could probably have better national policy supporting pulse. Right now, having so much variation, it's a challenge to explain and then try to figure out policy that will adapt to all of the needs of the different states. And then hopefully something else that's helpful for states is that it can eliminate duplication of effort and expenses. You know, by having a national forum, we can all put our money in one pot for translation rather than every single state having to pay for their own translation or their own education because they need to show that their section is slightly different than another state. So this national forum was created. It was released September 2019, and it truly was a collaborative effort. I think this is a really good example of what we can accomplish together. It's a product of almost 2 years of interviews with state leaders, consensus building, feedback, 7 different iterative versions of the form were sent out to the states for comments. We had a lot of assistance with patient guides. And all the states were offered an opportunity to participate, and almost every single one did. And then we included a lot of external partners and patient advocates. So I'm excited that Arizona and Maine have adopted it and are using it. Massachusetts has indicated their intent to use it in about 3 years. 5 other states are working to adopt it now, and 20 have indicated that they're considering adopting it in the next 5 years. And this can be revolutionary for pulsed and really getting it more accepted and understood nationally. So to answer your other question about what other barriers do we have aside from the issues with having 47 different versions of the form, the rest of the barriers are also ones that we deal with all the time. I started off our podcast with the fact we have 16 different names. This is actually a big deal because at the end of a conference or webinar presentation, I can almost guarantee I'm going to be asked a question about whether or not what I've just talked about applies to MOLST. Or whatever acronym that state is using, which means if the person's focused on that question the whole time, what was the rest of the information that they were getting? And then otherwise, we're constantly educating about who pulsed is intended for and why, how pulsed differs from advanced directive, the fact that pulsed is a process and depends on informed shared decision-making between the patient and provider. It is not a checklist. This needs to be collaborative between the patient and provider. And finally, that pulsed needs to be voluntary.
Yeah, maybe I can also just add, some of our listeners are no doubt aware that at our virtual House of Delegates meeting, AMDA approved a resolution last month that supports adoption of the National Pulse Form and other efforts toward increased standardization of the form and the order sets, and also to promote honoring of pulsed orders across state lines. So that's the exact details haven't been finalized, but basically it was approved overwhelmingly by the House of Delegates.
You know, and just a follow-up question, Ms. Vandenberg. So I'm envisioning the Massachusetts MOLST form in my head because I have completed it perhaps a gazillion times. Is the difference between it and the national form just a matter of wording or as folks think about their own state's form, is the national form just something completely different than what they've been used to?
It depends on what state you're in. For the vast majority of people, if their state is either endorsed or working towards endorsement, meaning that they're implementing their processes and doing their education and developing their form to match national standards, this form is going to look very similar to their state. Mm. Again, it was built on consensus. I reviewed a lot of state forms, and the decision was really we wanted to focus on what could most states adopt and use now? What would make this easy? And again, if a state adopted the national form, we wanted to make sure it was still going to be able to be used among those endorsed states whose forms are similar. So for those states, there isn't a huge change. It has national on it instead of their state. For some states like Massachusetts and others that we had previously called gray states, they were states who have created something that doesn't conform to national standards, it's going to look different. And I'm saying Massachusetts because their form doesn't have that typical section B that is really the heart of a pulsed form that says what medical interventions the patient wants when CPR and DNR is not the question. So this is where we're talking about full treatments and going to the hospital, selective treatments, going to the hospital but not the ICU, or comfort-focused treatments. Massachusetts broke those up, so your form is going to look different from ours. A couple other states have gone different directions, and so the national form is going to be substantially different. But again, for most people, this is going to look similar.
The success of your practice depends on a support team that knows exactly how to navigate through the many variables and nuances of post-acute medicine. Based on years of practical clinical experience, the team at U.S. Post Acute Care is dedicated to enabling you to deliver the very best quality of patient care, providing a unique complement of administrative and clinical educational support services. To learn more about what U.S. Post Acute Care can do for your practice, visit uspostacutecare.com.
We're talking with National Pulse Chief Executive Director Amy Vandenbroek and Dr. Carl Steinberg about Pulsed. Dr. Steinberg, I want to change up our focus a little bit and talk a little bit more about action and application. There appears to have been a definite uptick in the recommendations to conduct advanced care planning during this COVID-19 crisis, both by National Pulsed and by agencies such as the Center to Advance Palliative Care. To many now, it almost seems counterintuitive to urge medical professionals to have discussions, document advanced directives and goals of care, and complete pulsed forms during this crisis, as opposed to prior. As we have heard comments about who may or may not be a candidate for ventilators during this pandemic, and I'll tell you, I have even heard rumblings about the term death panels again. Lots of questions. How can this pandemic be a good time to have advanced care planning discussions? And, you know, even when we're thinking about CPR, now we have challenges to undertake CPR. Can advanced care planning conversations, pulse generation, be as beneficial today as during a non-stressful time? And finally, given the necessary distancing between provider and patient, how do we overcome the logistics of communicating via telehealth, satisfying the legalities of signing and adequately conveying the pulsed into the medical record at all?
Yeah, that's a whole lot of question right there, Wayne. But I'd say to start out, this pandemic is almost a perfect storm for advanced care planning, you know, because many people of all ages are becoming increasingly ill. So, you know, this is a good time to say, you're 20 years old, you know, why do you need an advanced directive? Well, I mean, look around, there's 20-year-olds that are dying. And and you've got that, and the fact that many people also have a lot of time on their hands right now, including family time, whether that's virtual or in person, where these matters can be discussed. So I think we have seen an uptick. And really, it is a perfect time to discuss these things because COVID has changed a lot of things. You know, the specter of rationing of ventilators has really frightened some people, including, you know, the disability community and such, and probably with good reason. But that's a whole nother podcast. But with COVID, the prognosis for people who require mechanical ventilation especially in the geriatric and nursing home population, it's absolutely dismal, right? I mean, it's like a 97% mortality in that series out of New York. So people who might ordinarily make a decision saying, yeah, you know, I don't mind going on a vent for a few days, you know, if I'm septic or something, and there's a pretty good chance I'll come out of it. Whereas now you're talking about weeks on a vent, you know, at high pressure. And but so patients have a right to have the information to make these decisions, you know. And again, these decisions may be different in light of COVID. So there's been talk of, you know, COVID specific orders on a pulse, and there is a free text area. So you can certainly write in, you know, no ventilator if it's COVID pneumonia or something like that. But ultimately the reason for pulse is not, you know, as far as your death panel thing, it's not to give less treatment or to reduce costs or to decide who gets to live or die. This pulse exists expressly and completely to help ensure that people are making informed decisions about their own personal treatment wishes, and to help them achieve that, right? Get the level of treatments they want, but not be subjected to treatments they don't want. That's really what it's all about. So, I mean, I think that's the biggest take-home message. As far as your question about witnessing and signing and that sort of thing, the pandemic has changed some of that, you know, as far as inability for in-person access. Like, you know, families aren't able to come in and visit their nursing home loved ones now. And some may not have technology where they could fax or scan or, you know, sign a document. So there are different initiatives in different states and some executive orders and so on that have relaxed that for the time being. And I think, you know, moving forward, we're going to see more electronic signing, electronic witnessing, and, you know, which is a great thing, electronic registries. And maybe, Amy, you can talk a little bit about that.
Yeah, there has been a lot of interest in moving towards registries. We've got a map on our website. If you go to pulse.org/map, you can find a registry map. You can see about half the states are working on something along those lines. Nationally, we're working on trying to standardize data sets to make sure that a form can be transferred, the data elements of the form can be transferred between registries, electronic health records, and health information exchanges, wherever it would be kept. The goal at the end of the day is to match the patient to their form when it's needed, and electronically is certainly easier than asking the patient to carry it around with them at all times. I would just add to Carl's points as well that the pulse form was intended to be dynamic in the first place. The whole point of it is to make sure it matches what the patient wants as things happen. So if their prognosis changes, if their medical condition changes, if their goals of care change, this is a very easy form to void. A patient can void it themselves by writing void on it, although they should tell their providers that they've done so. But it's very easy to void and then create a new version of it. And we know from registry data that a fair number are updated on a monthly basis. So it's very adaptable for this time. For verbal orders and consent, we certainly encourage still having the conversation by phone. There are a lot of materials out there on how to have that conversation over the phone or over Zoom or whatever. And then writing verbal order on the form, making sure that you document it in the medical record, and then trying to get signatures as soon as you can. There are some states that still require real signatures being on the document, but I know that states are trying to address that. And then finally, I know that the interim rules from HHS have expanded our use of telehealth. So we're allowed to use a lot more, a lot of other systems to have these conversations, to talk to patients and their families from what we were able to do before. And I think that's been very helpful for using Pulsed and making sure it's the right thing to use during this time.
So it may be a silly question, but as someone who is used to making home visits, I often come into a home and I'm looking for, you know, in Massachusetts, the bright pink form that's supposed to be on the refrigerator. So if we are doing everything visually or virtually now, how do we convey to emergency personnel that the orders exist and they have been documented when they can't see the document itself today during COVID-19, perhaps?
Well, I mean, I would say there will probably always be a paper component to it because of that exact reason. I think having something visual that can be printed up and put on the bedpost or the refrigerator is going to be super important for people who dwell at home. And in the same way that, you know, a bracelet or a medallion or those types of things can also be available. So I don't think this will be exclusively, you know, in place of paper documents, but I think it'll just add an additional layer of access to those documents.
Yeah, I agree with that. There's a lot of, it's partly driven by patients and it's partly thinking about what would EMS be able to find at that point of an emergency and just trying to give as many options as possible, but trying to be consistent. So right now there are some states that have pulse magnets, for example. We know that those are on the fridge, so we can train EMS. If you go in, you can find this information here on the refrigerator or, again, in the medicine cabinet. Those are the two places they mainly look for the paper versions of the form. Increasingly, bracelets, you know, even just putting up a sign that I have a pulsed form, you know, as long as EMS can find it, they can connect to it electronically. And I think there's just a little bit of lag right now with COVID between having that paper form, if you've completed it over the phone or electronically, to the patient actually getting a copy of it, depending on, you know, what technology the patient has. Can they print off a copy? With electronic versions, a lot of states aren't using colors or requiring color use anymore. And instead they're taking that white version of the pulsed and putting it maybe in a pink envelope so that the patient still has the color that EMS might be looking for, but the form itself isn't necessarily that same color. And so just trying to find what works best for everybody is the goal.
So as has become customary in the time that we have remaining, I typically like to be a little provocative with my guests, but not too much. And we've had such a productive discussion, but I got to tell you, here's my reality. And I know I'm not alone. As of last year, one of my facilities was completing a pulse on everyone who came to the facility, regardless of health status. This generalized use of pulsed, you know, considers pulsed a means to an end. You know, after 30 years, why are we still using this form incorrectly, especially given everything we've talked about today? With all the education, tools, and forums, how do we help others to understand the best use of pulse? And what will a successful future look like when it comes to this aspect of approaching end-of-life care?
Wayne, I wish I could give you a simple answer on that. I mean, I sometimes feel like just bashing my head against a wall. You know, we have tried to bring the message, along with our Department of Public Health in California, that pulsed is not a code status document. It's not for every nursing home resident. And it's very hard to get that message across. Nursing homes don't want to have two different types of forms or, I mean, there's all kinds of excuses for it. I will still see forms that say, yes, CPR, but comfort-focused treatment. I mean, it's completely internally inconsistent. I also see forms that, you know, they leave a sticky note on the paper chart and the doctor comes and signs a blank pulsed form. I mean, I just feel like I want to strangle somebody. I mean, these are life and death documents, and yet, you know, there's that level of sort of carelessness that is sometimes utilized, and that's by no means the norm, right? That's an outlier, but I think education alone doesn't seem to have really moved the needle that much. So, you know, National Pulse believes that pulsed forms, pulsed orders are for people nearing the end of life, not just for, you know, a patient who's coming into a nursing home for rehab and who just wants usual care, right? Everyone should have an advance directive that names another person to make decisions on their behalf. But pulsed is about specific medical treatments, you know, in light of an individual person's specific medical conditions. And so it's not something that should be handed out like candy, you know, at the admission desk. And there's some disagreement. Some people believe that it should be used as a generic code status document, but here's the problem you get into, and that's a whole nother podcast too. But people who just want ordinary care fill out a full code pulse. They're like, yeah, I want CPR, you know, I just want you to try to revive me if I go down. It implies that they want their life prolonged till the last possible instant. Then they lose decisional capacity, and now you've created a conflict when a family member says, oh, I don't think he would want to be on a long-term ventilator or that sort of thing. That's just one of multiple reasons. And, you know, maybe Amy, you want to articulate a little bit more, but I think what the future should look like is people who do post forms should have a robust conversation so that they can make a truly informed decision about specific interventions, whether they want them or not. And then those forms should be followed. They should be revisited when appropriate, but those are medical orders. And, you know, emergency rooms shouldn't be saying, oh, look, you know, it says DNR comfort care, but look, the person has a UTI and it's totally treatable, so we're going to treat it. That's not what that person wanted, right? That's so we shouldn't be paternalistic. We should do these things right, and then we should follow them.
Yeah,
I completely agree with everything that Carl said. I guess from my perspective, I look at it that people are requiring Pulse with best intentions. They see that it's a good thing and they want everyone to have it. But I think that also means that they're, I don't know if this is too strong, but they're violating patient self-determination and the ideas of informed consent and the principles of person and family-centered care. We acknowledge that patients have a right to participate in medical decision-making regarding their treatment plan. So just as they have the right to refuse treatment, they should have the right to refuse to do advanced care planning. The California Healthcare Foundation did a survey a few years ago that showed about 18% of people don't want to have this conversation. Mm-hmm. And when you force them to, you're forcing them into a conversation they don't want to have and maybe making decisions that they don't want. And that feels uncomfortable, at least to me, and for National Pulse. So I appreciate the intention, but it ultimately can harm National Pulse as well, because then people have this negative view of it and the people around them have this negative view of it. And that's obviously not something we want to create. I'll also add that, yes, Carl is absolutely right. We have a misunderstanding about code status and how it's being used in nursing homes. And that's one of the values I found out of doing the National Pulse Form Project is we have this wealth of information of different challenges that states are seeing. And we had an opportunity to try to address some of them. So for example, on the national form, we make it very clear, if you choose CPR, you must choose full treatments. This was a lengthy conversation among the state leaders about intubation and CPR and what happens in the field. And so the form tried to address some of these things to help providers use this properly, because also the last thing we want is someone to have an invalid pulsed form and not recognize it until the moment it's too late. So.
We have been privileged to speak with and learn from National Pulse Chief Executive Director Amy Vandenbroek and leader in post-acute care and policy, Dr. Carl Steinberg. I wish to thank you both very much for spending your time with AMDA on the Go.
Thanks, Wayne. A pleasure.
Yeah, thanks for having us.
References for this podcast can be found at the Society website, paltc.org/podcast, and the National Pulse website, POLST.org. Until next time, I'm Dr. Wayne Saltzman for this innovation podcast that we call AMDA on the Go.
Support for this podcast is brought to you by U.S. Post-Acute Care. If you are a physician and interested in obtaining ABPLM pre-approved certified medical director credits for certification or recertification, go to our new learning management system at apex.paltc.org. Click on podcast and follow the link to this latest episode. Thank you.